Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for spending some time with us tonight. We promise to make it worthwhile and have put together what we think is a power-packed lineup, two great guests, two topics that are bullseyes for the Coast paradigm. In the second half tonight, Diane Corcoran returns. She was my guest a year ago and is one of the world's leading researchers into near-death experiences, a topic that is slowly gaining credibility in scientific and medical fields. Colonel Corcoran first learned about near-death experiences from wounded soldiers on the bloody battlefields of Vietnam, where she worked as an Army nurse. Since then, she and her colleagues have made some amazing progress and advances in understanding this strange but all too common experience and what it might mean for us as individuals and as humans. She'll be here 2 hours from now. But first, UFO investigator, author, and filmmaker Robert Hastings returns to the program. In the UFO field, as you probably know, there are a lot of people who purport to be experts on this or experts on that. Just ask them. They'll tell you. I can state categorically that no one, at least in the civilian sector anyway, knows more about tonight's subject than Robert Hastings. He spent 40 years looking into bone-chilling accounts of UFO incursions over nuclear weapons facilities, the labs where the bombs are made, the sites where they're tested, the silos where the missiles are stored, ready to go, processing plants. It's taken Robert a long time to pull together all of this evidence and testimony, but he has now finished what I would call his masterwork, a documentary film about the link between UFOs and nukes. I've seen it. It delivers the goods. He joins me in just a moment. Because we've got so much ground to cover tonight, I'm not going to lollygag. Just two things to say before we're joined by Robert Hastings. First, if you were listening earlier this week, you may have heard our colleague George Norrie announce that Coast to Coast AM had won a very cool honor. It's called the Genesis Award. It'll be presented in early May at it's just a star-studded event they have in Beverly Hills. I've been to these things before. They're a lot of fun. A lot of big-name film and TV stars are the ones on hand to present the awards to broadcasters, journalists, filmmakers, producers for programs that address animal welfare issues. And the winners, it's an impressive bunch of folks if you look at the list. So we're really in good company. Coast won for a show we put together last year that looked at factory farming, if you remember that. Why we all have a stake in how our food is raised. You know, what happens to animals in these despicable conditions found in so many beef producers and pork producers and poultry, dairy, eggs, you name it. And as I told you at the time we did that show, I do think this constitutes a conspiracy of sorts in that the public is deceived. There's a disconnect between the food we eat and how it's produced. And if we knew how it's produced, then we would demand changes. And that is happening. And I think our show helped give it a push. I want to add to what George said by thanking the producer who really busted his butt to put together a terrific lineup for that program. Six guests, I think we had that night. A lot of juggling involved, but Chris Boros really pulled it off. And I'm very thankful he works as my producer on Sundays. I want to thank the rest of the Coast team as well, but I think I'll do that at the end of the program. We don't say thanks enough to this team, but it's a great team. And I'm really proud of this. The Genesis Award is a really big deal, and we are humbled to receive it. Second item, a quick mention that our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, who was my guest, if you'll recall, last Sunday, has helped put together our NAPS news list tonight. It's there on the Coast website, a couple of UFO-related stories, including informed speculation about what aliens could or should look like, according to scientists, as well as a peek inside the CIA. And then there's a story that something I really enjoyed, the link between hot peppers and revolutionaries. You'll have to read it to understand that. Check it out when you get a moment, NAPS News. While you're there on the Coast website, you can find out how to become a Coast Insider. It's still a great deal. You get to listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on any device, and it's a bargain when you subscribe. With that, let's assume the position. Dog and cat inside the house. Fire up the coffee pot, slip into those jammies, and a special thank you to all of those who've been sending me additional information about your particular jammies, by the way. We're all one big family here. Turn down the lights, turn up the radio, because we are ready to rumble. Back in a moment with UFOs and nukes. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. UFOs are not a threat to national security. How many times have we heard that over the years? Out of the mouths of the military, Pentagon, government officials. UFOs are not a threat. That's what they said when they shut down Project Blue Book back in 1969. No threat. Move along, folks. Nothing to see here. We don't think there's much to it. Well, what if it could be proven that UFOs have monitored, interfered with, seized control of nuclear weapons, traipsed over nuclear missile bases, over nuclear bomb factories, shot down missiles that have purported nuclear warheads? That would certainly seem to count as national security, wouldn't it? Robert Hastings has been chasing this particular line of inquiry for almost 40 years, and he's got it nailed down. His book, UFOs and Nukes, came out in 2008. Now he's got a film, a documentary. It's powerful testimony by firsthand witnesses, honorable military men who've come forward and put themselves at risk to tell this story, along with documents squeezed out of the government that I don't think they really wanted to release. And if this isn't proof, I don't know what is. Welcome back to the program, UFO investigator, author, and now filmmaker, Robert Hastings. Good to have you back.
Thank you, George.
You are coming to us from Niagara Falls tonight. You're not getting married, are you?
No, I'm giving a lecture later today, actually, at the Niagara County Community College in Sanborn, New York. And please show up. There's plenty of seats available. And I'll be doing that, hopefully, after a good long nap after tonight's program.
Well, I hope you're going to show some clips from the film. I watched it earlier tonight, and I've seen pieces while it was in production, of course. You've shared some stuff with me earlier, months ago, but man, the finished product is just awesome. I mean, am I overselling it to say it's your masterwork?
I, at the risk of sounding immodest, no. It's exactly what I had hoped it would be. It is factual. It is documented. It is everything that most of the TV documentaries on UFOs, and I use the word documentary very loosely, are not. I mean, the reason this film was made is because what I'm seeing nowadays on television is pretty pathetic in terms of factual presentation of the subject. There are exceptions, but you know, I've characterized the current genre of UFO programs as the fluff and bullshit group, and I was trying to be everything those weren't. I was actually, following the publication of my book in 2008, offered production slot on 13 different programs and different producers in the U.S., Canada, and England to be a part of the program. I knew I wouldn't have control. I knew that the odds were that the net results would be not good. So amazingly, a friend of mine, Jared Tarbell, and his wife, Lori. Jared is a co-founder of Etsy. Check it out, and they believe in what I'm doing, and they've made available a very significant sum of money to make this film, and so they certainly deserve all of our thanks. You may recall when I was on last with you in November of 2014, we actually did a public funding, crowdfunding type of pitch, and we raised an additional $14,000 from the public. Mr. and Mrs. Tarbell put up over $150,000. So
wow.
Again, everyone owes a debt to these two people to make this film a reality.
Well, it's an amazing production, and we're going to talk a little bit in a bit of how our listeners can see it. But I don't know if you can ever get your money back from it, but you've been down. I want to talk briefly before we get into the substance of the film about the journey to make it, because I know that you had hopes of having a network or some studio or something like that come forward and help you fund it. But it was important for you to maintain the integrity of the material. So you ended up having to turn that stuff down.
I made an effort last summer over several months to find a network that would be interested in licensing this unsuccessfully. Some networks, like the History Channel, won't even allow independent producers to approach them. You have to go through a distributor. But the networks that I did approach didn't seem to be interested. I've been told by other producers that most networks will turn down independent productions if they're one-offs, if they're not a part of a series. And so that may have been part of the problem, but in any case, we subsequently approached a couple of distributors. One of them did offer us a deal, but the terms were so abysmal that Jared and I decided we would take this straight to the internet via Vimeo on demand. And the way the paradigm is changing as far as how people access programming, this may not be as sort of out in left field as one might initially perceive it. I think it's a growing demand on the part of people, young and old, to have on-demand programming, and we now certainly fill a niche at Vimeo.
Well, who knows what the final product could have turned out to be if you had signed a deal? Because, I mean, you look at the stuff that's on, it's you called it fluff and BS. I mean, it's almost worse than that. I mean, the speculation and just wild, total. And there's a lot of UFO and alien-related shows on, and I don't think yours fits the mold of what those guys are looking for. That's for sure.
It's absolutely the antithesis of what's available on commercial television nowadays. You know, if this gains a groundswell of public interest, if people look at the film and go, holy cow, you know, how come I'm not seeing this on the news, you know, every night, then who knows, somebody in Hollywood might wake up and go, you know, we can do something with this on a larger scale. I'm still going to be as obstinate as I've been for the last several years. I'm not giving away anything in terms of agreeing to let other people make decisions about the film. If they want what I have to offer in no uncertain terms, then I can work with a larger, you know, corporate entity. But that's non-negotiable.
Let's jump into the content itself. We'll come back to discussing the film and how people can see it a little bit later. Let me ask it this way. What constitutes proof? You know, you heard my introduction, that statement that you've heard so many times, UFOs are not a threat to national security. And the skeptics out there rightfully say, well, look, what proof do you have? I mean, what proof do you need beyond what you've got? Describe for me the kinds of evidence you have and the weight it should have if it were evaluated fairly.
The word proof is sort of in the eye of the beholder. I've tried to avoid using that particular word. What I have is anecdotal evidence from very persuasive sources. My father was in the Air Force for 20 years in 1966 and 67. Our family was at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. It was then and is to this day a Minuteman nuclear missile base. And long story short, rumors were swirling in the spring of 67 about strange aerial objects maneuvering around the missile sites. I actually happened to see five of these unknown targets on radar. People can go to my website and get the details. But in any case, my father, who worked at the military radar building called the SAGE facility, the SAGE building, was also hearing from the actual controllers there, the radar people, that objects having capabilities beyond anything we have or the Russians have in terms of their velocities and maneuverability were indeed repeatedly maneuvering around nuclear missiles outside of Malmstrom. That sparked my interest when I graduated from college a few years later. I quickly became aware that a man named Raymond Fowler, very respected researcher, who worked for the Minuteman program at Sylvania Corporation, had actually gone public for the first time, and based on information he was getting from his contacts at Malmstrom, was the first person to publish in 1974 in black and white information suggesting that UFOs were hovering over nuclear missiles and affecting their performance. By 1973, I was fired up enough about this being real and important and worthy of public attention that I began actively seeking military veterans, Air Force veterans, to see what they might know about this subject. By 1981, I had enough on-the-record testimony that I possibly foolishly quit a full-time job and went out on the college lecture circuit. I felt so strongly that this deserved public scrutiny. And that was, 35 years ago, and I'm still doing this. I think this is nothing that the scientific community is going to address in the near term. The journalistic community, obviously, it treats this as a ha-ha story more often than not. And the government itself is simply not going to come clean on the reality of all of this. So what are we left? Persons such as myself who want the facts out really have no choice but to engage in a grassroots public information program. That's what my lectures have been about, my book has been about, and that's now what the film is about.
You had this event a couple of years ago at the National Press Club, in which you and a panel of your witnesses told reporters, and there was a gaggle of media there, this story that we're going to be discussing tonight. CNN streamed it live. I remember seeing the video, the audience, and you had a really good turnout there. There was a lot of coverage. Why does it go away? I mean, you would think you'd hook at least a couple of those journalists. Hey, this is a really interesting story here. Let's follow it up, more than just a one-day item.
You would think. Seven former Air Force officers were discussing for the world media, including, as you said, CNN streamed it live, the fact that UFOs have repeatedly shut down American nuclear missiles, knocked them offline. They've hovered over nuclear weapons storage areas. They've hovered over silos, nuclear missile silos under construction. That's what these people were saying to the world. And if one goes to my website, ufohastings.com, on the homepage, there is the full press conference as aired by CNN. And you can see these individuals, describe all the things I just mentioned. We were optimistic. Bob Salas, the co-sponsor of the press conference, he's a former nuclear missile launch officer. He and I were convinced that given the initial bump, that we would get some sustained interest in this. But much to our dismay, this story very quickly died. There's this concept of the 24-hour news cycle, and what is today's news had better be very, very hot and very important if it's going to be covered tomorrow, because the media has moved on. One would think, out of all the journalists in the world, other than yourself and Billy Cox and the late Terry Hansen, maybe a few others that I could name, you guys are pioneers in your field of journalism who have probably suffered the slings and arrows over time, been the barb of ridicule from your colleagues and disdain, or at the very least, you're ignored because you press this issue repeatedly year in and year out, much to your credit. But, as you know, your colleagues just are not going to look at UFOs as a serious news story. So all I can say, I guess, is people like you and I, George, need to keep on keeping on. It's one foot in front of the other. This may or may not break in my lifetime. I'm going to be 66 soon, but certainly, it's coming. I mean, the day of reckoning is coming. The government is going to have to acknowledge the reality of all of this sooner or later.
I before we jump into the specific cases, I just give you an impression about the early part of this film, the reminder that this film gives the viewer about the horrors of nuclear war. We've all seen the Terminator movies, and we assume, yeah, humans will survive, and we'll fight it out against the machines, and or some other scenario where we survive in bunkers and then have to fight zombies, whatever. It's been Hollywoodized so much, I'm sorry to use that term, but that we forget just how horrible it could be. And the beginning of your film is kind of a reminder of it, just how serious the consequences are when you're dealing with nuclear weapons. So any force that seizes control of them, interferes with them, messes with them, is a really serious matter.
I think that's absolutely right. And the further we get away from the Cold War era proper, younger people especially really don't have an appreciation of the fact that this planet was on the edges of its seats. I mean, humanity was held hostage by the nuclear powers, primarily the U.S. and the former Soviet Union, for decade after decade after decade. Most people have heard of, if they don't know much about, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we came very close to having all-out thermonuclear war, which would have been, there are no words.
Lights out. Yeah, there's no coming back.
And in my book, I devote a whole chapter to the Russian government and the American government, and years later, decades later, have finally admitted there were at least 20 other occasions where we were minutes away from launching nuclear missiles, one side or the other, because we misinterpreted the other guy's actions. And most people are unaware of that. It's worth noting that we still have, even though the nuclear arsenals that we in Russia possess are have been greatly downsized compared to the 1970s, there still are enough nuclear missiles and bombs and other delivery systems that if...
I'll tell you what, Robert, I'm going to interrupt you there. We'll pick up this part of the conversation and then get into some incidents, some specific incidents, including some new witnesses that have come forward who have not been made public prior to... just recently. We'll be right back with more of Robert Hastings, UFOs and Nukes, here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Robert Hastings about something substantive and provable, and that is the connection between UFOs and nukes. His new film is out. We'll tell you how you can see it in a little bit, and in a moment, we're going to jump into some new witnesses and specific cases that are bone-chilling. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Hastings, before the break, we were talking about, in general, the stakes, how they can't be any higher when you're messing with nuclear weapons. And the incidents that we're going to be covering here in the next hour or so detail some pretty scary stuff that happens where, in some instances, these UFOs, whatever they are, wherever they're from, whoever is inside, whomever, take control of nuclear weapons. I mean, the stakes could hardly be higher. What's going on with this kind of gamesmanship? It would seem like if whoever they are wanted to go ahead and take us out, they could.
That's the big question. It's clear, not only based on my research, but other people who pointed to the fact that these nuclear weapons-related cases have gone on for decades. This seems to be a fundamental element of the UFO phenomenon's interaction with humankind at this point, and also I maintain one of the primary reasons the government is trying to keep this from public view. You simply don't want to voluntarily tell your citizens, let alone your adversary, that you no longer have control over some of your weapons because they're being shut down or even temporarily activated by unknown powers, flying craft that are orders of magnitude technologically advanced to human technology. You don't voluntarily discuss that. You know, who knows who they are, why they're here, how they get here, all of the big questions. But it's clear if one looks at the film and the testimony that's provided in my book that you have scores of nuclear missile launch officers, targeting officers, missile maintenance personnel, missile security guards saying UFOs have routinely monitored our nuclear weapons and have from time to time tampered with their functionality. Those were that was the big message at the press conference in Washington that CNN streamed. You would think, as we said, the media would sit up and take notice, but no, they haven't. It's quite appalling in my view.
Well, I mean, you've got cases that we will go into in detail where nuclear weapons are disabled, and then you have cases both in the U.S. and in Russia where they are enabled, where the codes are in. They're launched and ready to go, and the countdown is underway, and then it stops. I mean, that's pretty scary.
It is, and one wonders, you know, what the motivation is. I maintain that whoever are doing these things to the weapons are perhaps just trying to scare the hell out of the nuclear powers and, you know, try to bring home the point that, do you really want to do this? Or there could be some other reason. One Russian journalist, Inessa Kornienko, who I was with in touch with some years ago, interviewed some of the Soviet missile personnel, and, you know, she's of the opinion, and I don't disagree with it, that in the cases in Russia, for example, that you are responsible, George Knapp, for bringing to the world attention. We can discuss that if you'd like to in a bit. Kornienko believes that whoever is flying the UFOs are intentionally activating the missiles so they can learn how the countdown sequence works. So in time of war, they can disrupt it, presumably or hopefully. But I think, you know, my take on all this is speculative, as is hers. Anyone, I mean, if the Pentagon knows exactly what's going on, or their counterparts in Russia, they're certainly not sharing that information with me.
Yeah, Colonel Sokolov, the guy that was the head of the secret Russian UFO study, who had helped us obtain these documents about that incident in the Ukraine at that ICBM base or missile base, had said that in their opinion, and they were just guessing, it seemed like the UFOs were sending them a message that these may be your most powerful weapon systems, but they don't impress us that all that much. We can control them anytime we want. That's
right.
A pretty frightening message to deliver to a superpower, supposed superpower. And it also, you know, it makes you wonder, maybe the government shouldn't come clean. I mean, that would scare the hell out of people.
I heard you say that during your interview with Tom DeLonge some weeks ago, and, you know, I respectfully disagree. It is what it is, and it's not going away, obviously. And if, you know, a government has something this big to hide, one has to ask whether it's being hidden for their own interests or whether or not it's really in the best interests of the public. Nuclear weapons really need to be eliminated. I mean, if one analyzes the situation, they came about in time of war. It was dog eat dog, and you know, one could argue that the bombing of Japan, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki were certainly justifiable within the context of the time. But once we started building stockpiles, the weapons started proliferating here and in Russia and another handful of other countries that were allied with us. It became clear the situation became threatening not only to the human species, to civilization, but to the planetary environment. I mean, if we had ever engaged or ever in the future engage in full-scale nuclear war, the planetary environment is just going to be terribly impacted for a very long time. Radioactive elements will just be all over the northern hemisphere, primarily due to wind patterns. And, you know, the consequences to health, you know, genetic defects, pollution of the you know, environment for animals, you know, let alone the human race. It's the fact that we have not seriously gotten together our act and gotten rid of these weapons after 70 years is just a sad, appalling testament about our leaders. So, I'm not terribly sympathetic to the people that say we need to keep this secret forever. If somebody on both sides of the ocean, they're here and in Russia, are saying again and again, pay attention, we can shut down your weapons, you know, we can activate your weapons, there's a message in that, in my opinion. And if governments don't want to give up their weapons because it gives them some sort of leverage in the international poker game, that is, you know, just not justifiable by any stretch of the imagination, in my opinion. We need to get rid of the weapons.
Well, I'm on the same page with you about the government coming clean. I think the public should know about this stuff. If people in government can handle it, then people out of government can handle it. My point being that I can understand where they're coming from. If these kinds of incidents happen on a regular basis, I can see that the thought process would lead to, I'm not sure we should come clean on it. But not that I agree with that position, but I know where you're coming from. What would you do with North Korea then, if you dismantle your nuclear weapons?
Well, I mean, clearly, I don't have the answers as to how this would all play out, the machinations in terms of negotiations. And clearly, you have rogue states like North Korea, and I mean, conceivably even Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons, that, you know, there would have to be some sort of overwhelming international pressure put on them to eliminate the weapons if the major powers, if the U.S. and Russia were going to eliminate them. But it's a goal that needs to be more than a story on page 12, you know, buried at the bottom. It needs to be front page news year in and year out until these weapons are eliminated. I think if the public here and around the world knew, if they had it in their mind that the things that I've uncovered and presented to the public are real, I'm simply the messenger, but I am presenting the testimony of people who were entrusted with launching World War III by turning the keys and sending their missiles to Russia. And so forth. If people realize that these are the witnesses that I'm bringing to the public, and their testimony in many cases is buttressed by documents, this is real, this is important, it should be a front page story year in and year out.
Let's talk about some of the material in the film. I was encouraged that you went beyond what the book was. The book was great, but you didn't stop there, and you didn't just make a film version of the book. You added so much more. And the cases continue to pour in. I mean, a lot of these things are, you know, that you note that it started with the beginning of the nuclear age. Right from the beginning, there were instances and incidents at American facilities that you're now able to document in pretty specific detail. But it goes right up to current times. Toward the end of the film, let's start there. There's an incident at a base in Wyoming that is described as a power failure. But you have indications that it is far more than that. Go ahead and tell that story.
My press conference was September 27th, 2010, and not even a month later, the Atlantic magazine broke a story by a reporter, or I guess associate editor named Mark Ambinder, in which he said that FE or an Air Force base in Wyoming for a period they claimed of 59 minutes were unable to communicate with 50 of their nuclear missiles. In other words, five launch silos, launch control capsules, what they now call, I think they call them MAFs nowadays. They've changed the terminology, missile alert facilities, each one controlling 10 missiles. Five of those, according to Mark Ambinder's story, the base couldn't communicate with them for 24 hours or for 59 minutes. Well, I knew there was a very high likelihood that something was going on that was not being covered in the media. I mean, all the media, including CNN, picked that story up, but I dug into that, made contacts with some of my former and retired military sources who had active duty contacts at F.E. Warren, and long story short, by the first part of December, I knew for a fact that the incident went on for 25 hours, not 59 minutes, like the Pentagon claimed. And according to two different missile maintenance personnel, there were sightings all over the missile field of a huge cigar-shaped object moving through the sky, both in the day of the incident and again over this 25-hour period in daylight following the initial disruption. So there were credible inside sources saying that there were UFO sightings of a huge cigar-shaped object. Clearly was not a blimp. It had no stabilizing tail fins. It had no passenger gondola. It was simply a metallic cylinder that appeared to be monstrous in size. And it occurred, these sightings occurred precisely when the missiles, when the base couldn't communicate with these five missile sites.
And that base has had activity like that before.
Decade after decade, and that's the hallmark of my research, is that the few stories that people hear about at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 67, where two flights of missiles were shut down over an 8-day period, 8 days apart, by UFOs, those were just the tip of the iceberg. This has gone on at every missile base, every nuclear bomber base, year in and year out. And if one looks at the film, you'll get a sense of that, a taste of that. While we were in commercial, I got an email from someone. I haven't evaluated the story yet, but someone saying there have been sightings in the Malmstrom missile field in 2015. I'm going to be in touch with this person and, you know, make sure that this is a legitimate story. But I can already tell you that in the last 2 years, I've talked to civilians who have property, you know, with a missile site on it outside of Malmstrom Air Force Base, who've told me about UFO sightings in 2012 and 2013. It's going on. It's still going on.
That's how it works, too, for you, right? You appear on a program or you give a lecture, and quietly people come forward. Hey, I was stationed at XYZ, and they start giving you information. I mean, you continue to collect this stuff.
It's ongoing, and I'm very scrupulous about vetting these people's credentials, especially the military veterans. They need to provide documentation to prove that they were in the Air Force and at the base that they said they were at when these events occurred. I try to get names of secondary witnesses who could corroborate their stories, which is rather difficult. Many of these cases are 40, 50 years old, but there are a number of cases presented in the film where you have multiple source testimony, different people all describing the same type of event. For example, at Malmstrom Air Force Base's Echo Flight, On March 16, 1967, I've got one of the launch officers, Colonel Walter Fiegel, now retired, saying that he got a call down in the launch capsule of a large round object hovering over one of the missile sites. Within seconds, all 10 missiles dropped offline. I independently found one of the electromechanical technicians, a man named Hank Barlow, who went on camera and said, "We responded to the emergency. We brought up four of the 10 missile sites. On the way, we were told, keep your eyes open for UFOs." And I asked him, you know, did that strike you as strange? And he said, we had heard that a number of times. We'd be out in the field and job control, as it's called, would call and say, we've got reports of UFO activity in the area, keep your eyes open. And Hank Barlow said that all of the missile maintenance teams, including himself, had seen a number of UFOs over, you know, 2 or 3 year period at Malmstrom.
You also came up with, and I just saw an article maybe a week or so ago, two new witnesses in a well-known case, Bentwaters. And it's actually expands the parameters of Bentwaters a bit.
This breaks it wide open, in my opinion. Back when I was writing my book, it occurred to me somewhere around 2005 that I had never seen any on-the-record testimony by the air traffic controllers at the RAF Bentwaters Tower. And if there were bona fide UFOs, presumably they were being tracked by the Americans at the base that we leased. And so I found out who those guys were, you know, that were on duty that week, Hank Barlow and Jim Carrey. I interviewed them on audio tape in 2007, and in 2012, I interviewed them on video. The video interviews appear in the film. These persons say, and you know, no uncertain terms, they tracked a bona fide UFO that covered 120 miles in 8 seconds. That's based on the size of the range of their scope, 120 mile diameter. This object crossed the screen completely in less than 2 sweeps, total of 8 seconds. So it went 120 miles in 8 seconds. Jim Carrey says on camera in the film that when it left the vicinity, it actually did a 90-degree right-angle turn at high speed on its way out. The other controller, Ike Barker, actually saw the object out the window hovering over a nearby water tower. He said it was an orange sphere. He said he thought a basketball was being flown by somebody. He said it had portholes around its equator, its center, that seemed to be emitting an orangish yellow light. And he confirms that this object was clearly not man-made technology. Now, for decades, the skeptics have tried to explain away all the Rendlesham sightings, all the Bentwater sightings, as misidentifications of a lighthouse beam through the woods or a meteor or a satellite coming down. It's clear that with the testimony of these two controllers, we have empirical evidence, radar data by the two people who were on the job that week, saying this was a bona fide UFO. It was orders of magnitude beyond any aircraft we have. And they said, quite frankly, both of them, we knew that our careers would be in jeopardy if we talked about it, and so we kept our mouths shut until I interviewed them.
Have you had witnesses that come forward who tell you bits and pieces of a story, a fantastic story about when they were stationed at some base, and it turns out to be just a bunch of baloney, and you have to, that you in effect discredit them?
That's happened twice in 35 years, 43 years, if you want to go back to the first interviews I did in the 70s. On two occasions, I got suspicious in midstream. The story kept changing. It kept getting better. These were people clearly, for whatever their motivations were, you know, not being truthful, and those stories have never appeared in print. In every other case, you have, I mean, many of the witnesses, it takes years before they're willing to talk to me. I make initial contact. They show up at one of my lectures or whatever, and I really have to cajole them and say, you know, this is your duty, in my opinion, to tell your fellow American citizens about the reality of this. And most of the people eventually come around and let me tape record them and use their names. But on two occasions, I had people that, for whatever their psychological makeup, felt they needed some attention, and I shut them down. I never published what they had to say.
I would think there are times when somebody would try to discredit you by providing information that turns out to not be valid. We're talking with Robert Hastings about his new film, UFOs and Nukes, The Secret Link Revealed. Coming up in the next segment, we'll tell you how you can view it. And here's a little song that is appropriate, I think, for the discussion tonight. It's Nina, 99 Red Balloons, a German band's tale of how to accidentally start a nuclear war. This is one way, anyway. Stick around.